This is Canadian Wealth Wisdom by TriDelta Private Wealth. My name is Kyle Taylor, Wealth Advisor and Portfolio Manager with TriDelta. I am joined by Cameron Windsor, Head of Equities and Portfolio Manager of TriDelta's Growth and Pension Equity Funds. Cam has spent over a decade with TriDelta, but previously worked with Franklin Templeton, RBC, and Scotiabank in a career spanning almost 30 years. Welcome, Cam.
Hey, Kyle. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Before we begin, it should be noted that this podcast is intended for general information only and not as specific investment advice. You should always speak to an investment professional to determine the appropriateness of any investment or investment strategy and how it relates to your specific situation. That said, the TriDelta team welcomes a conversation to learn more. The purpose of this series will be to discuss recent market developments, what we are watching, and ultimately what action TriDelta is taking within our growth and pension equity strategies. Cam, before we go any further, maybe you can take us through what the two equity strategies are and how they're managed.
Sure. We have two. The first one is a growth fund. This one, essentially, what we're looking to do is to find names with the best performance potential over the next year or two. Essentially, what we do is we use quantitative, technical, and fundamental processes to try to select our stocks. And generally, the strategy is what I would call style agnostic. So it's not looking specifically for growth stocks or value stocks, momentum stocks. It's trying to figure out which style was working and which style is best fits with the current economic environment. So that one is very flexible and it moves around. The other one's a little bit more static in its mandate. It's called a pension fund. The primary goal here is trying to have lower volatility, trying to have a higher yield. So basically every stock that we're buying has a decent dividend yield to it. It has lower turnover, so less tax implications. And, you know, both of these funds have done quite well since I've been here. I think even the pension fund is up over about 9% annualized since in the time that we've been here. So
yeah. And the last 3 months are no exception to that, especially given the market volatility. Well, we typically spend most of our time discussing the prior 3 months in these quarterly recordings. Much has changed in the world as we get farther along into April. Before we get into Trump's tariffs and how markets have performed since the April 2nd Liberation Day, and I did quotation marks with that, maybe you can set the stage for us on what led us to this point.
Yeah. So, I mean, essentially, this is what Trump campaigned on. Mm. He came out, he was talking about tariffs and the beautiful, you know, tariff being the most beautiful word in the world. So that wasn't a surprise. You know, he had his first administration. He lobbed a number of salvos China's way in particular. And so, as I say, the fact that he was doing and involved with tariffs didn't seem to be a big surprise. That his first opening salvo was at Canada and Mexico was, I think, a really big surprise for a lot of people. Everyone thought we had the USMCA agreement and essentially trade, you know, besides a little couple tiffs here and there about, you know, whether it's dairy or hardwood or, you know, there's some legacy issues that just kind of float around on that. But that was, I think, a very big surprise, and no one saw that one.
Especially considering they negotiated the agreement in his first term.
Exactly. It was the best agreement ever negotiated.
Yeah, at the time. But
so, anyways, we know that you know, Trump's thoughts or Trump's standpoint works as long as it doesn't work, and then he can change it. So, which is, anyways, that's his own prerogative, and he's out to do what's best for the U.S., so I get that. You know, ultimately it came out, I guess, was it the infamous April 2nd?
Yeah.
With the board showing all of it, all of the tariffs. So, again, to go back to, we heard reciprocal tariffs. So, in the grand scheme of things, if you thought that Europe had a average tariff of 10% or something like that, that he would lob 10% their way. Yeah. You know, but then all of a sudden he comes out with a formula that is dramatically different than looking at existing tariffs and pulls in trade deficit as the primary calculus for coming up with it, which, again, I can kind of squint and kind of see where he's coming from with that. And, you know, he's just simply looking for more ways to sell U.S. goods to the world, and, you know, perhaps ways to encourage more manufacturing within the U.S. for things that could be made there. I think he's painted a pretty broad brush on everything, and, you know, again, it seems like this is a little bit of bluster. The bark is potentially worse than the bite, and that things will calm down and tone down to a more civilized level that won't completely blow up the global economic landscape.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of a summary.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, certainly investors have grown increasingly frustrated, just as businesses and consumers have as well. What were investors expecting going into that April 2nd announcements, and what was the reaction?
Well, I think, again, they were expecting the reciprocal tariffs, and they were expecting something that was significantly more measured. So, like, that's what threw the world economy for a loop, like, especially, you know, when you're looking at, you know, the vast majority of what, at least in the U.S., is, you know, purchased from a mass manufacturing standpoint, we know isn't manufactured in the U.S. And if you're getting a, you know, I believe it was like a 49% tariff on Vietnam, which, you know, you had a lot of companies kind of, you know, like in the last, even the last Trump administration, you know, they saw the writing on the wall that maybe China isn't the best trading partner to have exclusively, you know, so then they went and diversified to the Cambodias, the Vietnams, the Indias, all of these countries. And then for them to get hit with these significant tariffs, that was obviously a very big surprise. So
how have the companies been reacting? Business decisions change? Is it sort of all up in the air?
I think all up in the air is a pretty good way to summarize it. Like, I just think it's a little bit too soon, because, you know, you look at, if in the grand scheme of things, like so many of these products are just absolute non-starters to try to move back. There was some news out today that someone had kind of done a rough, you know, calculation of saying, okay, if we were to actually assemble iPhones, not manufacture everything, because you've got a gyroscope that's made in Greece, you've got a touch screen that's made in, or the glass is made in Australia, you've got the camera that's made in Japan, the battery's made in South Korea. Like, you know,
yeah,
you're not going to pull all of that technology into be building within the U.S. But just if you just assembled it in the U.S., your cost would be going up something like 90%.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, are people really going to be thrilled with going from a $1,000 iPhone to a $2,000 iPhone? You know, so as I say, a bunch of that is pretty much non-starters. And essentially the U.S. has been importing deflation for decades through, you know, the offshoring, much cheaper labor. You know, businesses will come back to the U.S. if they can make the costs work, but that's also going to involve a lot of automation, I think, for them to be able to make the costs work, which a lot of people are foo-fooing that with saying, well, you're not bringing jobs back. Well, you are bringing jobs back. You're bringing, you know, you're not going to fill a factory floor with 200 people, but you might put 20, and they're high-skilled labor. And you know what, it's a significant value add potentially to the economy, because, you know, there's all the knock-on effect of, yeah, you've got the 20 in the factory, but that factory also had to be built. That factory also has to be supplied with you know, all of the things that factories get supplied with. So, like, there is a lot of potential knock-on effects. So I think, again, it's a valiant effort. But, again, places aren't going to flip the switch tomorrow and go build a new factory somewhere. You just simply can't do that.
And that's just adding to the uncertainty for the businesses too, right? Because Trump has a 4-year term. A lot of these business plans require much longer than 4 years. What are the rules going to be in 4 years?
Yeah, or 4 weeks.
In 4 weeks. There's like, a lot of even people in the Republican Party that are coming out against tariffs. So it does beg the question of, you know, how do these businesses, how are they expected to act in the near term when they can't know the future for sure, right?
Exactly.
I think I had read, you know, you brought up the iPhone from Apple, that instead of moving manufacturing to the U.S., they're just moving into other low-tariff countries.
Exactly.
Still higher tariff than it was a few weeks ago, but cheaper for the American consumer, going to erode margins a little bit, but it's not going to drive costs up the 90% that you referenced.
Exactly.
Right? And even one of the countries you brought up was Vietnam, and Nike employs 450,000 Vietnamese people to make their clothing and their shoes. You know, do they really expect to be able to hire that amount of people to work in the U.S. and pay them the wages that they need to be paid?
Well, that's the thing. Like, again, if it were to come here, they're not going to hire 450,000 people. They'll maybe hire 50,000 people, but put in the technology. But also, again, are there even 50,000 people? Like, the U.S. unemployment rate is still down toward historic lows. Mm-hmm. Like, there is not an ample amount of labor available to pick up and be employed. And then the other thing is, are they skilled labor enough where they have the technology or the training, like the background, to go and work with a robotic future? Which, you know, it's you know, planning a country, planning a government is a lot of work. And you know, if you're going to do these monumental shifts and changes, then you also have to make sure that things are trickled down all the way to, you know, the high school education system. You know, that kids are coming through being prepared for these jobs of the future, which,
and more people entering trades as well, which I know is an issue in Canada as well. Just
exactly,
we probably had the conversation in the past that even if we in Canada wanted to build the houses that we need to just meet demand, we simply just don't even have the labor to do so.
Exactly.
So forget about the money and the incentives to get it done. It's just when you don't have the people, you don't have the people.
Exactly.
Certainly has upended the last two decades of a globally integrated economy to more of a regionalized one, certainly. How have you been managing the market volatility within your strategies?
Well, we started the year fairly cautious. The risk-reward was skewed to the more risky side, as generally, you know, we were seeing higher valuations across the majority of stocks, declining earning prospects, and a couple of cracks in, you know, the potential economy. You had the number of jobs openings were less. That was kind of one of the first salvos that you kind of saw. You know, you see unemployment starting to tick up. So there were a number of concerns that we had had. So again, we were running with an elevated cash levels. We also had some option strategies to help generate a little bit of income and then also protect on some of the downside. You know, we've been using the sell-off to gradually increase our equity exposure and buy some of the names where, you know, we like the valuation. They've got an attractive growth prospect and, you know, and things seem to be intact on the underlying. You know, one thing that we like to look at here is sentiment as well with the market. And, you know, sentiment was negative beginning of the year, but it really blew out in this last little decline. So we've been a little bit more aggressively adding to our equity positions in some of the names that that we like.
Good. Yeah, no, it's certainly reminiscent of the be greedy when others are fearful, the Warren Buffett quote. How have Canadian companies specifically reacted to the tariffs? I know we talked about how Canada and Mexico are sort of the two first ones hit. Automotive has been a topic of conversation, aluminum and steel. How have Canadian companies been managing?
Well, kind of in line. Again, it was a big surprise for everybody. And there's really not, as we said, a whole lot that they can do. You know, you can't move an auto parts plant and employees overnight and, you know, or rework an entire supply chain. We don't own any auto or steel aluminums, which were, as you say, like kind of the most affected. We do own a couple of manufacturers like NFI Group that manufactures buses. You know, they're able to cope with this. They have U.S. plants as well, so they can move some of their U.S. Demand down to production there, so they don't have to worry nearly as much about the tariff effect. We also own, like on the manufacturing side of things, Bombardier, which has been relatively insulated so far and, you know, exempt from what was the 25% tariffs. You know, again, they're a great company. They're continuing to grow globally, focusing on the service side of the business. And, you know, they've been using the sell-off, I think, actually to buy back some of their shares. So, again, strengthening their stock's position. You know, the majority of what we own is within Canada and selling within Canada. You know, you look at, we've got companies say like Rogers Sugar. It's been off, but like 90% of their sales are within Canada or elsewhere, you know, other than the U.S. We've got the Canadian banks, which, you know, they've got some U.S. exposure, but not really tariff related. Names like Extendicare, not hitting anything there. Northwest Company, Maple Leaf Foods, you know, one name that we have that's a pretty decent growth name is Aritzia, and that's been hit really hard, and it's got like about 50% of its revenue tied to the U.S. But I mean, in the grand scheme of things, they're in the same boat as every other retailer, and you know, if prices have to rise or if margins have to be cut a bit, everybody else is going to be in this, as I say, in the same boat, and they're not going to be severely disadvantaged versus competitors. You know, one of the other things that, you know, as we kind of already talked about was, you know, how little companies can really plan for this. You know, nobody knows how long or at what level, you know, or even if these tariffs will be fully implemented. You know, until companies have like a solid, maybe 4 or 5 year outlook, I don't think anything really all that major is going to occur. And I'm pretty sure, you know, the boards and directors are all sitting around coming up with plans A, B, and C and having some things. And, you know, whether this might just kind of inch the ball forward over the next couple of years, I think that's at a minimum. Companies will do something, but they're not going to upend entire supply chains, at least in the next 6 months.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly had in our written commentary that we don't expect the tariff to go away entirely, maybe lowered or renegotiated or some exemptions, but
yeah,
they made it pretty clear from the U.S. side that this is the policy that they want to stick with. In the written commentary that we put out too, we also highlighted some of the potential longer term good things, benefits for Canada that have been discussed. One of those was potentially bringing down the interprovincial trade barriers, which is long overdue, in my opinion, and a lot of others. And the other one, too, is important for even just speaking with clients, because we always emphasize having a diversified portfolio, different companies, sectors, geographies, different asset classes. Canada hasn't done a very good job about diversifying our own trade relations, right? We've been very reliant on the U.S., and of course, nobody could have seen this coming, but it paints a picture of, you know, there are other aligned countries out there, and that can open up new markets for Canadian companies. That could be a longer term positive, right?
Yeah, I mean, you just even look at our index.
Yeah,
you know, you've got, I think it's about 30-ish% financials, 17-ish% energy, yeah, another teens of materials, like.
Yeah.
You know, there's not a whole lot of value add there.
Yeah.
As far as, you know, it's one thing we go and we provide services or dig things or suck things out of the ground.
Yeah.
But as far as actually taking something, making something, and giving, you know, sending it out to the rest of the world, That seems like something that the Canadian economy could definitely work on.
Especially with our energy, that would be positive.
Yeah. But,
have there been any stocks, sectors, or geographies that may have surprised you?
Yeah, a couple of things. Like, as we mentioned, Aritzia was a name that we had liked. Valuation was fantastic. Growth prospects were very strong. You know, it seemed like a pretty unfair reaction, unless, you know, we believe that the U.S. or Canada are going into some major economic event and consumer spending is going to hit a wall. But I really don't see that happening. I think things can be moderated well enough before then. Another one of our names that I think was unfairly treated, you know, Robinhood. They're a discount broker in the U.S. that has been increasing market share. They've got plans to go global and spread their wings around the world, like, you know, after the announcement. And again, this is like a solely U.S. company, essentially. But, you know, like, they lost like 25% of their value when, you know, the announcement, like, you know, the day or two after the announcement came out on April 2nd. You know, we were able to buy some of it. We were able to add to that, and we were able to participate in what was a very good snapback. But, you know, as I say, there was just a number of things between the valuation, the earnings growth, and the potential for growing across, it just seemed pretty unwarranted. The Canadian financials were a relatively pleasant surprise. You know, again, everything's, you know, pretty much going to get hit a little bit and go down. But they were the relative outperformers in Canada especially. And, you know, they had been underperforming previously, like since the beginning of the year. You know, again, valuations had corrected. They were a name that we were underweight, or a sector that we were underweight, just simply mainly off of valuations and, you know, the potential that the bang for the buck wasn't there if there were some potential economic headwinds. But I think that's a sector that we'll probably be looking to add back to. And a number of other names that we owned were a positive surprise, holding up better than expected. We've got one named Bellring Brands, which kind of sells protein-based health products, and it held up relatively well despite having a higher valuation. And, you know, obviously being tied to the consumer, it's, you know, if you're worried about the consumer side of things, that would have been a name that could have been hit a bit, but that one held up quite well. Another one is MDA Space. They're a provider of a satellite and space exploration products. And they held up extremely well despite, you know, their sales going into the States and them being an industrial type manufacturer. So those were some two nice surprises there.
Yeah, no, those are good examples as well. Has the key been for companies that are managing the tariffs better than others being where their operations are located so like they can avoid some of those tariffs? They already have manufacturing or jobs in the country. Has that been the key, or is it?
It definitely helps.
Yeah.
It definitely helps. Like, I mean, there was one we'll call it a negative Canadian example, Stellantis.
Yeah.
You know, they shut down a plant in Windsor.
Yeah.
And, you know, basically they could presumably move. I don't think it was an actual, I think it was like more of a parts type of plant.
Mm-hmm.
Which that kind of leads to another thing where there were, you know, some stats that I saw recently about car sales taking a big jump up and people were trying to get in ahead of all this tariff stuff. So, you know, there could be the thing where, you know, for the next month or two, if you're, you know, selling cars, you could have a little bit of a drier spell as people were rushing to get ahead of the tariffs and, you know, pulling forward demand for a month or two. So,
we talked about that earlier today, actually. How much does that pull forward orders and companies having surplus inventory now to avoid the tariffs preemptively? How long can that last? Or is it dependent on, is there a recession? Does the consumer keep spending like they have?
Yeah. So, there definitely are some things where, like, inventories were ramped up ahead of this. There was one news report, as we talked about iPhones already, but, you know, Apple had chartered some planes from India and stuck like 1.5 million iPhones on these planes and rush them over to get them here before that type of a deadline. The other thing is you do have to remember that a lot of these international companies don't exclusively sell to the U.S. You know, they are selling into all these other markets across the world. Obviously, the U.S. is a juggernaut when it talks about, you know, consumer purchasing power. But, yeah, it's, you know, there are some things that can mitigate that.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's probably a good sign from Apple just to know that they're not coming out with another phone in the next few months because if they're ordering so many. So the big question, I guess, and this aligns with the theme of our written commentary, and that this too shall pass, but where should investors go from here?
In the grand scheme of things, stay the course. You know, if you're dealing with a financial advisor, stick with your plan. Take a look at your asset mix. If now's a good time to rebalance your asset mix, as I know, you know, a number of planners were doing that here over the previous months, and now it could be time to potentially, you know, look at your plan, and if it makes sense, then you could be adding to some of your equity allocations, as you know, there still is a pretty decent potential that, you know, things could be a little bit overblown here. And we have had these big declines, and historically, you know, you invest after some 20% declines, and you know, over the next 6, 12, 24 months, generally speaking, things are working out okay. So,
yeah, all very good points. I mean, the rebalancing one especially, because the last sort of long-term or longer-term decline that we had was really 2022. And that was a year when stocks and bonds were both going down. And this year, bonds have held up okay. They finished the quarter up 2%. So it has been an area where people can trim from and rebalance from without having to feel like they're selling something that's also down to go into equities and then kind of mismatching their risk profile. The other component really is just around, you know, having your long-term goals in mind and making sure that you're not making those emotional knee-jerk reactions because of fear, which is a painful response sometimes, and we know that that can really hurt people. I found it interesting when we were writing our written commentary that, and I completely forgot about this, that in 2018, when Trump, during Trump's first term, when he had announced tariffs on China, that markets actually fell 20%. And I'm sure if you asked 10 people, 9 people would say they've completely forgot about that. And it's because things move on so quickly. And who knows whether we're still talking about this in 6 months, 12 months, 2 weeks, who knows. Hopefully it's the shorter of the options, but you just never know. And that's why it's so important to, you know, keep those goals in focus. So thank you, Cam. That for any listeners who have not already read our Q1 2025 market commentary, I would encourage you to visit the Insights page on our website. That concludes this recording of Canadian Wealth Wisdom, and more specifically, our quarterly market update series. Thank you.